You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning Dr. Stephen Bezarushka, who is a local physician here in Seattle. Stephen, I know you teach at the University of Washington, amongst other things. Tell me what else you do.
Good morning, Mike. Yes, I work in local emergency departments. I'm an ER doc, and so I've been doing that for almost 30 years, and gives me a wonderful opportunity to see people with real problems and try and deal with them.
And on top of that, you also do lecturing locally, as well as write articles for the local paper, for some national magazines like Newsweek, which is kind of where we're taking part of our tack today. You had written an article for Newsweek back in 2001 entitled, "Is Our Society Making You Sick?" And I'm hoping that we can start talking about that. Is this society making us sick?
Well, it depends on what you mean by sick. And so what I do is try and look at health indicators among countries and see how America does. And one such indicator is the average length of life that people in America or other countries live, a so-called life expectancy. Born today, today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live? And these numbers are calculated every year by the UN, by WHO, and of course, by the American government. And if we look at the so-called Health Olympics, that is the ranking of countries by this indicator, how long you can expect to live, we don't do very well. We're about 25th. We're behind pretty well all the other rich countries in any measure of, this is in any measure of health. I'm not, besides health indicators such as life expectancy, we could look at infant mortality, we could look at disability-adjusted life years, and we don't do very well. We are so far behind the leader that if we did something as drastic as eradicate all deaths from our number one killer, heart disease, kills almost 40% of the population, if we eradicated those deaths and kept the other disease death rates the same, we still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. Now, we weren't always this way. In the early 1950s, we were in the top five. By 1960, we were about 13th. And we've sunk as, I think we're probably sunk as low as we're going to go. We're 25th now. I doubt if we'll drop much further. But this is a disgrace for the world's richest and most powerful country that spends almost half of the world's health care bill. We spend 42% of all the dollars spent worldwide on health care, and yet we don't have much to show for it.
So it's not a question of spending then. What would it be a question of?
Well, it turns out if you ask the question, what makes a population healthy? And I think of Thomas Pynchon's quote in Gravity's Rainbow, if you can get them asking the wrong question, the answers don't matter. I would say the right question is, what makes a population healthy? Now, in really desperate poor countries, not having enough to eat isn't very good. So you have to take care of basic needs, enough food, shelter, some water. Once those needs are met, the basic needs of sustaining life, then what seems to matter most for how healthy a population is some measure of the gap between the rich and the poor, the most powerful and the least powerful. The rich, what that does, the gap between the rich and the poor, is indicate something about the social fabric of societies. Societies that share more, that value the quality of human relationships, that have a sense of community, are going to be healthier than societies that isolate people, that make you feel inferior because you don't have a lot of money, that humiliate or shame you because you don't rank in the indicators in society. Andrew Grove said you get what you measure. And so that's a real reflection of a society. What does a society measure? We never measure our standing in the Health Olympics, so if Andrew Grove is right, we can't get that. What do we measure? Well, every minute of every business day, we measure the Dow Jones and the NASDAQ. And that's displayed all the time. I mean, you can't get away from it. So we must get what that is. And what is that? Well, that is a measure of wealth creation. So we must get wealth. And if everybody gets it, it can't be wealth. Wealth is only something that accrues to the privileged in society. But if you structure society so more people get more of a share of the pie, they'll be healthier. So in the 1950s, for example, when we were in the top five, What was going on then? This was after the Second World War, and we had a massive program of redistribution in America. We had the GI Bill, and we had housing, the VA housing loans. We had these bills where people could go to school, and so the poorest segment, the poorest fifth of America, actually gained the most income during the 50s and during the 60s. And so because we shared the resources in America with pretty well everybody, we were much healthier compared to other countries. That's to me the important thing to say. How do we do compared to other countries? Every year, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports that America's health improved over last year. And that's true. Health keeps on improving. That's a remarkable thing. But the important thing is, do you give the gold medal in the Olympics to the person who did better than last year or to the person who finished first?
So who's at the top of the health Olympics? Who's winning?
Turns out to be Japan. Most people don't think of Japan as the healthiest country in the world. And then when I point it out, they say, well, it must be their diet. But in 1960, the tables were turned. Japan was 23rd and we were 13th. So by 1978, Japan had pulled ahead in the Health Olympics race to be the healthiest country in the world, and it's been that way for almost 25 years. And so people say, well, it must be their diet, but their diet hasn't changed that much during that period of time. It must be that they exercise, and yes, they do exercise, but that hasn't changed either. And then I ask some people who've been to Japan usually, well, what else do you notice in Japan? And some people will say, well, they smoke a lot. And then I point out, yes, as a matter of fact, Japan wins the gold medal in the smoking Olympics. That is, out of all the rich countries, nobody smokes as much as people in Japan. Men in Japan, twice as many men in Japan smoke as in America. Yet, the price they pay from lung cancer deaths, from heart disease deaths, from deaths that we know are attributable to smoking, they pay half the price. Think about it. They smoke twice as much and pay half the price. Now, I'm not suggesting that people go out and smoke, but I am suggesting that, and smoking isn't good for you in any population, the smokers are not going to be as healthy as the non-smokers, but compared to other things, smoking isn't that bad. As a doctor, I used to rail against my patients for smoking. I did everything I could to sort of humiliate them for smoking or tell them to stop smoking. Of course, they all knew that smoking wasn't good for them. But now I never tell some. I mean, I put it on the instructions just because that I give people, just because, of course, you know, it is good health advice. But I blame myself for being a part of a society that doesn't share, and that the problem really is much more my problem than the person that smokes in America.
So in Japan, my understanding is that the difference between the wealthiest and the poorest is a little bit different than here in the U.S.
Yes, Japan's a complex situation to try and understand. But basically, if you think of Japanese people, you don't think of Japanese individuals. You think of groups of Japanese, right? Remember the last time you saw a bunch of Japanese traveling here in Seattle? You didn't see one person, you saw a whole group. And that's different. They think of themselves as one big family. And that means that the idea that somebody would make 500 times what an entry-level worker makes in his company is just anathema. Newsweek reports that they make 11 times what an entry-level worker. Sorry, Businessweek reports they make 11 times what an entry-level worker makes. And here in America, it's around 500 times, though 2 weeks ago in the New York Times magazine, Paul Krugman said that the new revised figure is 1,000 times. The boss makes 1,000 times what an entry-level worker makes. That's not very good for our health.
What are some of the factors you use for measuring the Health Olympics?
Well, it is this thing that's reported by every country, the life expectancy. Born today, today's mortality rates, how long can you expect to live? You could also use infant mortality. Out of 1,000 infants born this year, how many will die in their first year of life? And in that measure, we do just about as poorly. Namely, we're 25th in the Health Olympics. And the countries that are ahead of us, besides pretty well all the other rich countries, include some poor ones, Cyprus and Malta and Greece and Spain, and, you know, countries we don't necessarily associate with being very healthy. And just to the north of us is Canada, where Canada's number 7 in the Health Olympics. It's right up near the top. And it's not that much different than we are. At least some people feel that way. But on the other hand, it does have a social compact with the people. And it is a much more sharing society. I should know. I I was born in Toronto and grew up there.
Now, is it also because of their healthcare system there that they're healthier?
Yes. They don't spend as much money as we do, of course. But the important thing is that everybody has access to healthcare. And that, you know, healthcare doesn't have an awful lot to do with making a population healthy. I liken it to the Army Medical Corps. The Army Medical Corps doesn't decide whether we go to war or not. It doesn't decide the battle strategies, the ordnance, the weapons used, the protective devices used. It just goes in after, you know, it goes in and picks up the casualties and tries to do the best with them. That's the best we can expect of the healthcare system. It picks up the casualties of the battle. And so if you feel in America, as we have 45 million uninsured, if you feel that you can't have access to this system, you're going to be even worse off than if you, because of just how you feel that this is denied to you because you don't have enough money. Whereas every other rich country has a universal access healthcare system, and so people feel like, hey, my country cares for me, and I can have healthcare. It's also a way of redistribution. In other words, every society has rules on who gets what share of the pie. And if you have to pay for health services, then that's something that comes out of your pocket. But if it's decided that everybody has access to this service, then it's a way of redistributing funds or redistributing resources or wealth behind the scenes. In Canada, for example, you have universal coverage. Everybody has access. It's not a question of whether you can pay or not. And in the same way, you have education is much more heavily subsidized by the government. There are no private universities in Canada, for example. And the educational tuition fees are much, much less than here. And for public schools, for primary and secondary schools, the way in which they calculate how much money schools get is different. It's not based on the local county or city property tax allocations. It's based on a redistributive formula done at the provincial level. So that the province decides that schools in places that don't have high property taxes are going to have more funding than they would otherwise get if it was based on the formula we use in the United States.
How does the U.S. compare with Cuba in its health index?
Well, Cuba's 31st. It's just behind us. Now, some years it's been a little higher. It was about 29th or 28th a few years back. And Cuba's an interesting country because we've been strangling it for over 40 years. And yet, this incredibly poor country that has had these sanctions imposed upon it for this length of time is almost as healthy as America. And, Cuban Minister of Health remarked to a visitor once, you know, because Cuba's very poor, he said, we live like the poor, but we die like the rich. Because in any society, the rich are going to be healthier than the poor. And that's an important point. We tend to not think of the fact that it is the poor in America that pay a much greater price for in terms of poor health than the other segments of society.
What role does our for-profit healthcare system play in all this?
Well, I think just to step back and before we talk about our for-profit healthcare system, most people in America don't realize that at the government level, at the federal, state, county, and city level, the amount of money spent by the government per person in this country on health services is already greater than the per capita expenses in every other country on health care. So the government is already spending more than in any other country per person on health care. So if we wanted to have a system of providing health services through the government, we already have all the money we need being spent. So that then asks, well, what does for-profit do to that? Well, once you add in all the profits in this, of course, we can't possibly afford to provide this service for everybody because there's too much money to be... There's too many profits that would be lost in that process. I don't think that health services are the kind of thing that you should allocate by market mechanisms. No other country, all the other rich countries have in the past not done that, but One of the sort of aspects of globalization is that the rich people in other countries see that the American market mechanism for health services really creates wealth in the small segments of America that profit from health care, and so they want to emulate the American system. And so here we have this disaster here that other countries, that the leaders in other countries want to copy, and that's really not a very healthy situation. But I think the important thing to recognize is that American public, through surveys, have always wanted a universal coverage healthcare system. They don't like the idea of having to pay out of pocket or to have their insurance benefits through work regulated, so they are limited in what they can and can't do. 70% in many, many public opinion surveys, 60 to 70% of the public want a single payer healthcare system. It's not on the agenda.
And is that because of the healthcare industry, the people that are profiting from this already, being effective in preventing that from happening?
That appears to be the case. They structure the debate so that you have a choice of this plan or that plan, and this is America where we all have choices, but it's the wrong question. They structure the debate not on whether we should have a universal coverage healthcare system, but do you want paper or plastic?
So would it be fair to say that in some ways our for-profit system is literally killing people?
Yes, you could certainly make that argument. The evidence linking health care input to health output, health is measured by life expectancy, infant mortality, is tenuous at best. And part of that is because there is this phenomenon that I call medical harm that works in medical care. We make mistakes. And we also do things that result in bad outcomes just because of the powerful forces that, the surgical procedures, the interventions, the drugs. Literally, when you look at it, so much of medical care does harm. And there have been several studies done in America showing a very high rate of deaths due to medical care. Sometimes these studies get on the front pages of the newspapers. For example, in 1998, in the New York Times front page, they reported that a study showed that over 107,000 people a year die in hospital from adverse reactions to prescription drugs. And the Institute of Medicine published a report entitled, "To Err is Human." That is, that mistakes that are made in medical care are a major cause of death in America. But mostly what we've done is set up quality control committees in hospitals to try and make sure that you spell the name of the drug right and the dose is right and these kinds of things, which are very important. I think that we shouldn't neglect that. But at the same time, we need to sort of ask whether or not more medical care is really better for us. And all the studies seem to suggest that it's not. For example, when doctors go on strike, when doctors went on strike in Los Angeles County, for example, the anesthesiologists, because of high malpractice premiums, county coroner death rates dropped. When doctors went on a strike in Bogota, Colombia, for 52 days, death rates dropped. We find this kind of situation that when we withdraw what we think is absolutely life-sustaining and necessary for our survival, we don't sort of start dropping dead. The opposite seems to be true. This is really a paradox for somebody like me who actually works clinically as a doctor to try and confront. And so I'm often asking myself, should I do something or should I just stand there? And sometimes it's better to say, don't just do something, stand there. And offer compassion and offer concern and all. But if more is not going to necessarily help this person, don't do it.
So do you find yourself as a doctor then battling this for-profit system that seems to, from my perception, seems to say you need to crank out, so many prescriptions a year, you need to use our new type of machine and incorporate that into your daily routine? Is that a serious amount of pressure there?
Fortunately not for me, because I think if it was, I would probably find something else to do. By working in emergency rooms and emergency departments, thank God, one of the things that we can't do in emergency departments is turn people away. We have to see everybody. And you don't have these influences. You really try and do what you think is best, though, you know, we get more and more sophisticated tests, and we tend to think that they're better. And but at least in the situation that I work in, I have the ability to sort of work independently and think what is really best for the particular patient that I'm seeing. I ask other people's advice. I keep in touch with the studies and the literature. There probably are subliminal influences in which I want to use the newest and latest procedures, but I try to temper that and think what's really going to benefit the patient and what studies do we have out there to influence my decisions. There is this whole force right now in healthcare called evidence-based medicine. In the past, we thought of medicine or the art of medicine as an art. What doctors did was sort of a mixture of art and science. And there is this push to try and get more of the scientific studies influencing the day-to-day decisions that you make regarding the care of your patient. And that's a difficult situation because the studies really don't answer most of the specific questions that you're confronted with when you see a particular patient in the ER, for example. But you try to make everything as evidence-based as possible, but that is a major recent thrust in health services in America.
And then do you have to contend with a lot of those studies seem fairly rigged on some of them for particular company produces a particular drug and, you know, they produce several studies to support that their drug is safe, but we don't know how many of other studies were done where had bad results and then they pulled that study completely. Is that something that's in the back of your mind?
Oh, there's an awful lot of that. When you publish an article, you're supposed to disclose your conflict of interests, whether you are paid for by the drug company and whatnot. And it's despicable the ways that people get around that. For example, there was a recent study in the most prestigious medical journal in America, the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was about a study comparing drugs for psychiatric conditions. And it was a long article, and it was very interesting. And it was had many, many authors. It was a multi-center study. And at the end, they for the disclosure of conflict of interest, they said that there were two. It was too long to list in the printed version of the journal. Go to the journal's website. Well, if you went to the journal's website, first of all, you had to pay to get that information. You had to be a subscriber to the web part of the journal. And when you looked it up, it was huge. I mean, there were so many conflicts of interest among all the authors. They all were paid for. They were all employed by the drug companies. And, of course, you know, who pays the piper calls the tune. And you may not think of it directly that way, but it works subliminally. There's no question about that.
So you said that working in the ER, you're not necessarily so affected by a lot of this pressures from the for-profit industry. Do you think out in the bigger industry itself, though, that those pressures are greater?
Well, there's a new phenomenon that's happened in the last couple of years in America, and that's to direct-to-consumer advertising. You know, I grew up in the era where doctors never advertised. They had a non-bold-faced one-line listing in the telephone book about, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and that was it. And now advertising is everywhere, not just doctors offering to change the shape of your body to make you have erections and everything else, but they are offering... People are advertising, the drug companies are advertising drugs and basically building in a nag factor. They tell you, go to your doctor and nag the doctor to give you this drug. And then, of course, they have this long list of adverse effects that they're required to print. But this works. People, you know, it's so much easier to just write the prescription for the darn drug than to talk to the patient about how it won't necessarily help them and could even harm them. Much easier to, you know, the patient will be happier, the drug company will be happier, you'll have more time to spend with more patients, which is what the system does. It wants you to see people quickly, and I don't think many people benefit except the pharmaceutical companies that have profit margins that are much greater than all the other industries.
Yeah, I found that very intriguing. In the last couple of years, the number, for instance, just during the nightly news, the national news, they'll have it in any given half hour at least half a dozen different ads for these prescription drugs. And sometimes they don't even tell you what this drug does. They just, have some people dancing about and they're happy and they look like, you want to join their crowd. And right. To do so, ask your doctor about so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really disturbing.
It is. Unfortunately, it's going to become a more common practice in other countries too, because the drug companies are seeing that they can increase sales tremendously by this. One of the things that we don't realize is that drug companies spend far more money on marketing products than they do on research. They always say we need to do all this to be able to spend all this money on basic research for these great pharmaceuticals. But in fact, the data suggests otherwise. They probably spend 10 times as much money on marketing as they do on basic research. And actually, the research is mostly making copies of drugs, Me Too drugs. If somebody has there's going to be a new Viagra coming out by other companies because they can just find a slightly different chemical formulation that will do the same thing, and then they can get into the market too. Most of the basic research is funded by the National Institutes of Health and by the government. We actually pay for it. And so the costs of the research are socialized, but then we give the opportunity to make profits to the drug companies without paying a license to the people for having funded the basic research. So we socialize costs and privatize profits.
Yeah, and that doesn't even go into all the race towards changing, going to these third world nations and grabbing their natural remedies and stuff, mm-hmm. and slapping mm-hmm. patents on that as quickly mm-hmm. as they can and trying to profit off of that. We only have a couple minutes left, and I know you're going to be talking this weekend as part of a talk on NAFTA.
Actually, yes, it's the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA. And this is the sequel to NAFTA. Basically, right now in Quito, Ecuador, there is a meeting of all the Western Hemisphere countries, including our U.S. trade representative, that are trying to make these free trade agreements among all the countries in the Americas. So it's, and we, as an attempt to carry on the Battle of Seattle that happened in November of 1999, we have a conference at the School of Social Work at the University of Washington, both today and tomorrow, on all of these issues. And so I try to make the links between globalization and health and suggest that the FTAA is killing us. That is, what is free trade doing? In any studies, free trade seems to increase the gap between the rich and the poor. So that has a direct health impact. And so we have actually seen this as we've seen more and more free trade issues come about. Free trade, of course, is a misnomer. It really is corporate-centered trade. But as we have more and more of this corporate-centered trade going on, it increases the gaps between the rich and the poor, and you actually see adverse health effects of that. The most egregious example has been in the former Soviet Union. Most people are not aware that when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1992 and they jump-started to a capitalist system, the gap between the rich and the poor just increased immensely overnight, and all sorts of Soviet nomenclatura made it onto the Forbes billionaire list. And what happened to life expectancy in Russia? It dropped 7 years, and in other communist countries too. Now, health has kept on improving all of the last century except in two instances, and one is sub-Saharan Africa due to AIDS in the last decade, and the other one was the incredible health decline in the countries of the former Soviet Union. And the number of excess deaths there number somewhere between 15 and 20 million people have died because the life expectancy has dropped so rapidly. And that is really due to the same kinds of issues that are being debated in the Free Trade Area of the Americas.
All right, so you'll be speaking tomorrow from 11:30 to 12:30?
That's right, in the School of Social Work in a workshop. I think it's in room 12.
Room 14.
14,
is what
I've got
right now.
Okay.
And the School of Social Work is located at 4105 15th Avenue Northeast. And the whole thing is being put on by the Community Alliance for Global Justice. And if you want more information on that, I think you need to register. Their number is 206-405-4600, 206-405-4600, and they also have a website, www.seattleglobaljustice, all one word, .org. So, Stephen, thank you for coming in this morning. It's been enlightening.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk, Mike.
Just been talking with Dr. Stephen Bezrushka, who is a teacher here and at the University of Washington. And also, you are with, you are a...
I'm an emergency doc at a couple of local hospitals.